Welcome back to part two, the Kabbalah breathing, part two. So, I just wanted to begin tonight just with a very short review of last week. Last week we began with talking about Kabbalah in general and the evolution of the revelation of Kabbalah and how it all worked. We talked about Kabbalah being part of the Pardes, the garden, which cannot be divorced from the rest of the garden, and we talk about the four components of Jewish learning. The Kabbalah began to be revealed with the Zohar, which is about the second century, authored by Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, but under very sort of restricted limitations and context. Started to flourish a bit more in the time of the Arizal, 16th century, and then it came full circle, so to speak, with the Baal Shem Tov in the revelation of Chassidut, which was to really bring these lofty concepts. We said Kabbalah means you receive, you believe, you accept what we're being taught about what takes place in the higher realms. And then, of course, the Baal Shem Tov's sort of contribution was then to bring it down and apply it to how we live and how we serve God and so on. Now, we also talked last week about, I mentioned this because it'll become relevant a little bit more today in terms of the discussion we're going to have. We talked about the two organs that we have which are connected to breathing, primarily the nose. God blew into the nostrils of Adam the Nishmat Chaim, the soul of life. And we connected Neshima to Neshama, Neshima being breath, Neshama being the soul. Our breath is the manifestation of the soul, which is why in the last verse of Psalms it says, Kol HaNeshama, the entire soul should, or every soul should praise God. And the Talmud says it calls Neshima u'Neshima with every breath, as the Baal Shem Tov explained, every breath we should be able to connect to the soul through our breathing. The primary organ being the nostrils, and God blowing. The blowing connotation was that he blew a part of himself. We talk about the difference between blowing and speaking. And he blew through the nostrils. The nostrils is the organ of fragrance. As we said, there's five senses, and the one sense which remains pure and never gets distorted or damaged is the sense of smell, sense of fragrance, which is like the deepest part of the soul, which we're going to talk about a little bit later tonight as well. And then, of course, we talked about the mouth being dibur, being the vehicle of communication, and people are called communicators. We call them medaber, and as the Targum, the translation, the Aramaic translation of the Chumash, when it says that when God blew the nostril into the nostrils the breath of life, the soul of life, vayhi adam nefesh chaya, and the person became a living being, the Targum translates it as Ruach Memalala, a speaking spirit. Why is the essence of the human being communication? Because it is the part of the human being which allows us to become infinite, meaning to go beyond ourselves, to go beyond our personality, to go beyond our mold, our limited, finite mold, and to connect to something else, something higher. So there's that concept of relationships, which is through people, but then our relationship with God. So the essence of the human being then becomes communication, because communication is the tool of going beyond ourselves, the tool of infinity within the human itself, which is fired and enthused and guided by the soul, and therefore the soul gives us that, the soul which is the spark of the divine, the spark of godliness, gives the mortal, finite human being the ability to be godly in a sense and to be more infinite than finite. Okay. So that's the very quick synopsis of last week, right? As I travel tonight, feel free to ask questions, because I don't want to lose anyone. If I do, please stop me. Or if you have a question, please stop me as well. So what I want to do tonight is I want to take this to a bit of a deeper level. And in a way, share with you an idea that actually reflects and kind of symbolizes what Kabbalah and Kabbalistic meditation was all about and meant to achieve and so on and so forth. So let me just begin with this. We find today in the literature of mindfulness, literature of meditation, we find a lot of focus on breathing, as we said last week, which is true. But we also find a bit of a focus on deeper breathing, which they call diaphragmatic breathing or abdominal breathing and so on, right? And in many forms of meditation, that's very much encouraged, to the point where they talk about that the benefits seem to be researched nowadays and in terms of stress reduction, anxiety reduction, blood pressure improvement, and even treating things like post-traumatic stress disorder and so on and so forth. So I mention that because that idea is sort of more in the more recent literature. But as we spoke about last week, where we talk about breathing, the breath is an expression of our soul. So I'm going to share with you an idea which maybe we can call it the Kabbalah of deep breathing. I don't know, but it's the I think it actually represents a phenomenally deep idea that we find in the teachings of Kabbalah with regard to the soul. And then if the soul, in fact, if the way we breathe or the way we focus on our breathing is actually a expression of our soul, it makes sense, therefore, to actually focus on breathing, not just shallow breathing, but actually to fill our lungs or to fill our abdomen with and feel the breathing in the different parts of our body. Okay, so I'm going to take you on a journey, okay? Can't fall asleep tonight. Because I need to start with three introductions, which are, you won't see the connection at the beginning, but hopefully, if you don't see it, the connection now, it's not your fault, but if you don't see it at the end, it's definitely my fault. So I'm going to try my best. The first introduction is, and some of you might be familiar with this if you've done a bit of Kabbalistic learning, I want to talk about the 10 Sfirot. Now, Sfirot is a very spoken about concept in Kabbalah. Essentially, we know that when God created the world, the Arizal teaches us and the Zohar teaches us, God is infinite and undefined, but yet He chose to express Himself and to manifest Himself in 10 specific definitions, which then became the 10 tools of creation. And because the world is an expression of His creation, and the human being in particular is created, as we say, in the image of God, our soul also, our personality, our makeup, contains these, what we call the 10 powers of the soul. So if you take your hand, I'll just flip it to the other side. I'm going to run through with you, the 10 Sfirot is a subject of Kabbalah which has its own discussion and needs its own series. But I'm just going to share with you enough that we need for tonight, so to speak, right? There's different ways to talk about the 10 Sfirot, and they're listed in different places in different ways, but I'm going to sort of share with you how they're listed in the Arizal's writing in a concise way. So the way the Sfirot happen, it happens the way they're laid out, the way Kabbalah teaches these 10 Sfirot, is in three triangles and the 10th one, right? And the three triangles are divided into different, they're divided into three parts. The world of intellect, right, you see that? The world of emotional response, and in that world of emotional response, you can see two triangles. I mean by triangles, the right, the left, and the middle. Yeah. Once again, if you lose me, please stop me. And then we have Malchut Aden. Now let's run through them very, very quickly. So the whole makeup is right, left, and middle. Okay. And predominantly we're governed by the right and the left, and most of us are disposed either to the right or the left. I don't mean politics now, by the way, I'm talking about the Sfirot. And we'll see what that means. So, the world of intellect, which lives in our brain, the physical seat of intellect is the upper part of our body, the nostrils, the brain, and so on. We have Chochmah on the right, Binah on the left. Now, Chochmah and Binah are two critical parts of thinking, of cognition, of cognitive processing. Essentially, very briefly, Chochmah is the conception of an idea. So it's the flash, it's the aha moment of trying to work something out. Bina, which comes from the word binyan, to build, is the development of the idea. It's the edifice, this is the intellectual edifice of the concept. Daat is the middle, is when we bring Chochmah and Bina together, because Chochmah is the flash, the aha, the truth of the concept. Bina is the analysis of the idea. The truth must always live within the development of the idea, we bring them together and we connect to it. Intellect generally, if we think about something, it remains very removed from us, it remains very detached, and therefore will have very little impact on how we live our lives, as we'll talk about a bit further. And Daat is the way we sort of internalize it. So Daat is connection. So Daat is taking both the Chochmah and the Binah and really connecting to it. Okay. So that's the world of intellect. That's now. Now, I should say the following, that the soul, the essence of the soul, transcends. You see, these 10 powers of the soul are the conscious part of how we live. Okay, it's the 10 layers of our consciousness, really. The depth of the soul is not in our consciousness. The depth of the soul is deeper than our consciousness, transcends our consciousness. It's deep within our subconscious. In fact, especially that fifth layer we talked about is the depth, the ultimate of our subconscious. Okay. However, having said that, where the deepest subconscious part of our soul is manifested, is expressed, if we want to express that part of our soul, it's expressed in the world of intellect. Okay. What do I mean by that? Let's just stop there for a moment, because we know that the most powerful tool within the human being is our thinking, right? Meaning, have any of you read The Choice by Edith Eger?
Yeah.
Yeah. So she says that, right? I mean, and Viktor Frankl talks about it a lot, but I mean, that's a Kabbalistic idea, that it's the one part of the human being that allows us to be who we are not. Meaning like this, if we just lived our lives by our emotional impulses, we would live our lives exactly the way we were born. And sadly, some people do that, which is sad, because I mean, they never change, right? And we would follow our impulses, we'd follow our emotional responses, but we'd have very little self-control. How we make decisions, how we make moral decisions, how we choose wrong, right over wrong, and we make decisions which are beneficial and selfless and connect us to a higher purpose and a higher meaning is through thinking, right? As Edith Eger's mother said to her, everyone can take away anything from you, but can never take away what's in your mind, right? So self-control, for example, being selfless when our impulses drag us to be selfish is through the brain. We take a step back, we pause, right? If you've read Stephen Covey's Seven Habits, it's the pause where we pause in order to process intellect, so we can look at two sides of something, we can process information, we can process conviction, we can process values, and then we can make a decision. However, the decision doesn't naturally come from the brain. It doesn't naturally come from the intellect, because we know that people rationalize all sorts of things, right? The brain is just the tool. It's the greatest tool that the human being has. Because a person can also think in a very distorted way, right? We know this. There were atrocities committed by human beings, great atrocities that were rationalized in the name of morality, in the name of thinking, in the name of good decision making, right? So what really gives us the ability to go beyond ourselves, not to be trapped in our egocentricity, to really make good value judgments, to really make connections beyond ourselves, to free ourselves from ourselves, is not our thinking, it's the soul. It's the infinity of the soul. It's the godly spark within the depths of the soul. But where does that manifest itself? In our thinking. Does that make sense? In other words, the way we change, the way we grow, is by using the power of the mind. Or by giving mastery to the mind over the heart. Right? Which is really it's an old Kabbalistic idea, spoken about at great length in the book of Tanya, but it's very much the basis of modern positive psychology, really, right? It's the mastery, it's reframing, it's looking at something different, right? Which allows us to grow. If we wouldn't use the power of the mind, we wouldn't be able to grow. We wouldn't be able to go against our natural disposition of our personality, right? In other words, we are tempted by something, we're tempted to get angry, we're tempted to indulge in something we shouldn't indulge in, that's destructive for us. We tempted to get involved in an argument, in resentment, whatever the case is. And it's our mind which helps us make that decision not to do that. And therefore to go beyond ourselves and to grow as a human being. But it's not the mind. The mind is just a tool. It's the value. It's the desire for meaning, as Viktor Frankl puts it. It's the pursuit of something deeper that doesn't come from the mind, because the mind can go anywhere. It comes from the soul. It comes from that which is deeper than the mind. However, that which is deeper than the mind, are we okay? Are we making sense here? But that which is deeper than the mind lives in the mind. It always manifests itself through the mind, right? I say that because it goes back to what we spoke about last week, that vayipach ba'apav nishpat chayim, that God blew into the part of the head, which is the mask of the brain, essentially. The brain is behind the nose, right? God blew into the nostrils the soul of life. Not that is the intellect of the human being, but that is what is in the environment of the intellect, because it expresses itself through the mind and through the power of the mind. Okay. So that's, yes.
So
are you saying that the deepest part of our soul is resting in the mind? So I'm
you know, in Tanya it says the godly soul is in the head.
Okay.
But the godly soul is not intellect. It's in the moach, it's in the brain. But it's not intellect. It expresses itself through intellect. Because the godly soul is the part of us, the godly part of us, the deepest part of the soul, which is guiding us towards a life of greater meaning, a life of selflessness, a life of value, a life of purpose, right? How does that happen? Not through the heart, not through impulses. It has to travel to the heart, as we'll soon see. But it starts off by rational thinking. But it expresses itself in rational thinking. But what is guiding the rational thinking towards good rational thinking? It's something which is deeper than the power, right? Yeah? We're all good? Okay. Now let's have a look at the world of emotion, right? Which is... Now, I want to focus much more on the primary force of our emotional responses. So, by the way, emotions are very hard to define. So I'm going to give you the Kabbalistic definition. And emotion, in this context at least, is our response to something outside of us, okay? So love, hate, and so on, right? So normally emotions are feelings which are responses to stimulus which is happening outside of ourselves, right? Someone says something, we have an emotion, we hate, we do revenge, we're jealous, we're happy, we're sad, we're flexible, we're inflexible, we're tolerant, we're intolerant. It's all responses to the outside world, right? So the two primary emotions of every human being is chesed and gvura. Okay? This is really important now, what I'm going to say. Why do I say the two primary emotions are chesed and gvura? Because chesed and gvura are... Chesed is love and gvura is normally translated discipline, but they don't mean that necessarily. So let me just define it for a moment. Chesed is everything that involves going outwards, expansion. So it's love, it's flexibility, it's compassion, it's giving, it's generosity, it's empathy, all those things that allow me to embrace something outside of me, right? So we can have a long list of emotions, but they're all rooted in the concept of chesed. Gvura, on the other hand, right? Gvura, on the other hand, is the opposite. It's all about holding back, which is why aggression is gvura. Aggression means, I give aggression to something, but I'm rejecting someone, right? That's aggression. Discipline, in other words, discipline which would be a good thing. But gvura, by the way, is not bad. Often people think chesed is good and gvura is bad. It's not. Gvura can be very good. In fact, it can be fantastic. It's like to be disciplined. Self-control comes from gvura. It means I create boundaries. That's a gvura thing. I don't go where I shouldn't go. Organization. But bad things like intolerance, inflexibility, all these things are all part of gvura, right? Now, to simplify, and I say this because it's really oversimplifying it, because it's really much more complex than that, because each one of these seven incorporate the other seven, so you can have various shades and doses, and it's not for now, but just generally speaking, most human beings, not all, but most human beings, are kind of either chesed people or gvura people. I won't do it now, but I have a little cute test that I've done with groups to sort of, you can see if you're a, right? You know, I'll give you an example, like the people who always check the change after they go, or check the docket every single time they go to the store, like it's a kind of a more of a guru sort of thing. Not bad or good, by the way, right? I'll give you an example. I mean, when I say chesed guru, it's not bad or good. There's, you know, I always say, like, if you want an emergency lift to the airport at 3 o'clock in the morning, you ask a chesed person. If you want to run a project, you want someone organized and dedicated, you ask a guru person. Someone who's reliable, who says when they come 7 o'clock, they come 7 o'clock, you know, that kind of thing. So it's not a matter of good and bad. But, and the same thing we have in divine service and spirituality, we have places for chesed and places for guru. We know that the mitzvot, for example, that the Torah gives us are a combination of both. The chesed is more the feeling, the warmth, the enthusiasm of doing a mitzvah. The halachic part of it is the gvura, and sometimes that's what God wants. He wants you to do it correctly. So, you know, if you write a mezuzah, the mezuzah is not written correctly, it doesn't work. It's you know, you need a sofer that's more gvura. It's going to write each letter meticulously, and it's going to be kosher, right? That kind of thing. So chesed and gvura is very much a personality disposition. A lot of people sort of gravitate either towards chesed and gvura. You know, you have in parenting, for example, often when people struggle with parenting, it's either because they're too much chesed or too much gvura, right? Because either everything goes or everything is inflexible, right? So that's chesed and gvura, and really it's the two primary emotions of the human being. Tiferet, right? And this is why these things are in triangles. Every time the things are in the middle part of the triangle means that it goes very deep. The Kabbalah says that everything that's what we call kava emtsa'i, whatever's in the middle goes all the way up to the deepest levels, to the levels of transcendence. So tiferet is a very, very deep thing. What is the word tiferet actually means? I've translated here synthesis. Sometimes it's translated as harmony, but actually the word tiferet actually means beauty, right? And we are taught that beauty is created by diversity. So when you have, for example, the analogy given in Kabbalah is when you have a garment made of many colors, a multicolored garment, it's beautiful. Single color can also be beautiful, but the synthesis of colors matching together create a certain sense of beauty. Now, what's the concept of tiferet? Tiferet is the middle. What does that mean? So I'm going to give you an oversimplified analogy just for the purpose of this discussion. You're walking in the street. Some of you might have heard this from me before, but if you're walking in the street and you see a homeless person, right, who looks like they've eaten for a while and so on and so forth, a homeless person comes over to you and says, can I have $20, $50, whatever the case is, right? Because I want to buy something to eat. And there's good reason to believe that the person might use it for things other than food, right? Self-harm, destructive stuff. So the chesed person, again, I'm using a simplified analogy, a person who's pure chesed, for example, won't be able to say no. It doesn't matter, you know, they're going to use it for a heart melts, takes out $50, gives it to the guy, right? The pure gvura person, of course not, I'm not going to give the person $50 to go buy drugs, so just says no, finish, walks on. Both of these people are responding emotionally. It's an emotional response. One's responding with chesed, one's responding with gvura, right? But they're responding they're not responding to what the situation requires, they're responding what they need, what they feel. It's their personality, it's their nature that is responding, right? Someone who stops and uses and takes a pause and says, hold on a second, forget about what I want, what is needed here, right? And thinks about what is needed, will be able to channel the emotions to be able to sometimes have tiferet. Tiferet is the harmony between chesed and gevurah, right? So I'm using that analogy because it's easy to describe it. So what does the tiferet person do? The tiferet person says, no, I'm not going to give you $50, but I can see you hungry. Come, I'll take you across to the store and I'll buy you a sandwich. Right? You get it? So gvura, I'm saying no. I'm not going to give you what you're asking for because I know it's bad for you. But I'm going to help you. That's chesed. So it's chesed and gvura. Right? Now that particular person might be a chesed. I mean, some people are natural tiferet people, not so many, but the person might be a ches person or a gvura person, but they're willing to go beyond who they are. And the truth is that if we wanted to sum up what growth is all about, what personal growth is all about, what growth as a human being, as a Jew, as a person, as a soul is all about, it's exactly this. It's about using the parts of our personalities which are natural for good, but it's also going beyond our personality and using the parts of our personality that are not our natural disposition. And the only way you can do that is to go very deeply. We need to use the mind for that, and the mind needs to use the soul for that. So the mind takes its cue from the selflessness and the purity of the soul, processes the values, and then sends them to the heart, right? And the heart is able to then go and be guided by the mind, which might mean responding in a way that is not natural for me. Using an emotional response which is not my natural, impulsive, natural response. Is that making sense so far? Okay. So that's chesed, gvura, tiferet. Now there is another triangle in the emotion which I'm not going to go into. It's what we call the supportive. Netzach is ambition, hod is humility, yisod is bonding, which normally means the combination of both. But it's not necessary to go into that now. Now, finally, the last tenth one of the sefirot has its own category, and it's called processing and implementation, and it's called malchut. And malchut is an extremely important tool of the 10 powers of the soul. What is malchut? It's called leadership. Why is it called leadership? What is a good leader? Right? Why is it called malchut? What's a good leader? A good leader is someone, not as someone who's particularly smart or clever, because there are lots of clever people in the world that are shocking leaders, right? Absent-minded professors could be brilliant, but not necessarily they could be leaders, right? not everyone that's very kind is a good leader. A leader is someone who's able to take their power of intellect, their power of emotion, and process it and implement it. Actually make it work. Apply it. Right? So, for example, a person might be a chesed person, might be a very, very kind person. Right? A person can be a very kind person. He wants to sort of save the world or save his country or save his town. He's got all kinds of ideas and it never comes to fruition because he just can't make it work. Right? That person might have a full dose of chesed but doesn't have any malchut, doesn't have the ability of malchut. So malchut is not an emotional response in its own level. In fact, it's like it doesn't have anything to it. It's just a vessel. It takes all of the above. It takes the intellect, takes the emotion, and then makes it work, implements it. Clear so far? Okay. That's introduction number one. Let's move on because we're going to... Okay. The second introduction I wanted to give is... I want us just to have a look at a Kabbalistic idea, which we often find a pattern. You'll hopefully at the end you'll see how this all comes together. Okay, but that's the 10 sefirot or the 10 powers of the soul. By the way, God has his 10 sefirot also. In fact, we learn about God by examining our own powers of the soul, and that's how we work out how God relates to us, but that's for another time. So, we find an interesting relationship between the number 4 and 5. So I'll give you an example. Last week we talked about 5 senses, right? So the 5 senses of the person. But there's 5, but there's a big difference between the 5th and the other 4. So we saw the 4 is the ones that can be damaged, distorted, whereas the 5th one, the sense of smell, fragrance remains pure, right? This idea we find very often. So for example, have a look at the name of God, right? If you look at number 2 of your hand out there. Sorry, not number 2, number 3, right? So for example, you have the name of God. The holiest name of God is... the Yud and the He and the Vav and the He. 4 letters, right? What are these 4 letters? So Kabbalistically, the 4 letters respond to the 4 Kabbalistic worlds which God created to create our world, right? Known as Atzilut, Briah, Yetzirah, and Asiyah. There are 4 worlds. The way creation happens is God chooses these 10 powers to manifest himself, and that's the world of Atzilut, and then they evolve into the world of Briah, the world of Yetzirah, the world of Asiyah, and we are... outcomes of the world of Asiyah. Now, those 4 worlds, they are holier. The holiest one is the top one, the Yud, which is the world of Atzilut. This is God's world. It's the holiest world, but it's still a world. It's already when God sort of moves from being an infinite God into the, by choice, to be a defined sort of world. And then there's that what we call Lifnei Hishtalshlut, which means that which is above, the 5th level. Now, if you look, I wasn't able to find it in, but if you look at those letters that I put on the handout, right? You look at the second line. You know what I'm talking about? This, right? If you look at the second line, the second letter from the right, that is. Right? The Yud. You'll notice, if you look very carefully, that on the top left-hand side of the Yud, there's a little shtickle coming out, right? Yeah, that little piece. In a mezuzah, you'll find it in the Torah and Tefillin. We don't find it in the Siddur, because we don't have these. This is not the Torah font. But this is the font that the Torah is written in, right? That little thing on the top is called the Kutsoshel Yud. That's the tip above the 4. It's the 5th that transcends the 4. It's that which is higher than the whole concept of creation. It's God in his essence, right? We find this idea by Pesach. On Pesach night, what do we have? We have 4 cups of wine. Do we? Mm-hmm. There's also a 5th cup. Mm-hmm. The one that we don't drink. The cup of Eliyahu HaNavi, mm-hmm. Right? Same idea. Kabbalistically, the 4 cups respond to the 4 letters of God's name, the 4 worlds, and so on and so forth. That 5th one represents the tip on the Yud, the 5th level, the level of the essence of God, the holiest part, the purest part, right? And so it is with the soul, right? So in Kabbalah, we find an analogy. The soul is called a candle. Ner Hashem Nishmat Adam. The soul is a candle. And the soul also has 5 levels we spoke about last week. The 4 levels that can be harmed, and then we have the 5th level called the Yechidah, the essence, the purest, the fragrance of the soul, right? And those 4 levels are the candle of the soul, because the candle also has 4 things to it. Kabbalah teaches us we have the actual candle, the wax, we have the wick, and then we have the flame. And the flame has 2 shades of fire. You've looked at a flame, there's the darker light and the brighter light, right? Called Nehorah Uchma, Nehorah Chivra in Kabbalah. So it's the in Aramaic, in the Zohar. It's the brighter light and the darker light. Those are the four components of the soul. But then you have what's above the candle, the that which lights the candle, which is the essence of the soul, the fifth level, right? So that's the relationship between the four and the five. That's the second introduction. The third introduction is as follows. We are taught that the world is made up of four components, four properties, like, right? Everything in this world, Maimonides talks about this a lot, and Kabbalah talks about it a lot. That everything that is made up, I've lost the word in English there. It's made up of four
elements.
Thank you. Four elements, yeah, that's it, that's what I meant. Eish, Ruach, Mayim, Eish, Mayim, Ruach, and Afar. Fire, water, wind or air, depending how it's translated, and earth, dust, right? The human being, for example, is a lot of us is water, right? For example. Now, in Kabbalah, we are taught that these four elements actually correspond to the most crucial parts of our personality. Eish, fire, is Gvura. Remember we talked about Chesed and Gvura before? Okay. Eish is fire. Eish is Gvura. Why? Because water, so let's work the other way around. Water is Chesed. Because water pours. So water is a giving creation. That's why the Torah is compared to water, because God gave us the Torah. He poured the water down to us, right? When you feed someone, you give them, it's right? So water, its nature is to come from above to below, which is gravity, but it's the concept of giving, concept of bestowing, right? Lowering oneself to someone else and so on and so forth. Eish, fire, on the other hand, is known as Gvura. It's powerful, but it goes up, it goes away. It departs, which is Gvura. Gvura is moving away, right? Ruach, air, which actually doesn't go down or up, and it's also the least tangible and the most spiritual in this world, the most physical thing that is the most spiritual, is Tiferet, right? If you're looking at your triangle. So Chesed, Gvura, and Tiferet, which is the primary part of our personality, is Chesed, is Mayim, Eish, and Ruach. Mayim is Chesed, fire is Gvura, and Tiferet is Ruach. Now remember, what's Tiferet? Tiferet is that part of our triangle, emotional triangle, that allows us to go all the way up to the depth of the soul and create selflessness, create meaning, create purpose, and move away from who we are to what we're supposed to be, or what is needed, or what is beneficial for other people, or making the world a better place, or being selfless, or creating meaning and purpose, right? What's Afar? What's Earth? That's Malchut. Just like earth is down to earth, we say, right? So malchut means you can implement it. It comes tachlis, tangible. It's the most tangible of all the four. That's the concept of malchut, it's the concept of implementing it. But out of these four, so it's chesed, gvura, tiferet, and malchut, which one is tiferet? It's ruach, okay? We're okay so far? Okay, now, let's come back to our breathing and the neshama. I mentioned last week, here comes the amazing thing. So listen carefully how this all works. I mentioned last week that the Jews were in Egypt, right? And Egypt was a place of constraint. It was a place of slavery, not only physical slavery, but spiritual slavery. Moses comes along and he tells the Jewish people he's going to redeem them. They're going to become free. Now, we're 5 weeks away from Pesach, but the whole concept of Pesach, the whole concept of celebrating Exodus from Egypt is about celebrating freedom. It's about becoming intrinsically free, right? Not just physically free, geographically free, but freedom. So we are taught that the moment of Exodus actually brought about, we were given on Pesach the gift of freedom. Freedom means that ability to grow, the ability to make choices, the ability to live a life where we go beyond ourselves, where we go beyond our own limitation, where we go free ourselves from ourselves, where we go out of our comfort zone, where we go out of our egocentricity and so forth, which is, by the way, why Pesach is all about matzah. Matzah is the symbol of selflessness. Chametz, rise, is a symbol of ego. Matzah is a symbol of complete selflessness, right? Letting go of our ego, so to speak. So Moses comes and he tells the Jewish people he's going to redeem them from, he's going to give the gift of freedom. And the pasuk, the verse tells us, "V'lo shamu el Moshe." They didn't listen to Moses. Why? Mikotzer ruach. I mentioned this very briefly last week, but now I want to develop it. Mikotzer ruach. You hear the word ruach? Mikotzer ruach, because of shortness of breath. Mikotzer ruach, shortness of breath. What does it mean, shortness of breath? Physically, what it means is shallow breathing as opposed to filling our lungs with breath. What does that mean? What is the significance of that, right? Now again, so ruach is tiferet, right? Ruach is the part of us that allows us to connect to the essence of our soul. So now remember, ruach is the same word as reach. Reach means fragrance. Ruach means air, but same word. It means the purest of the spiritual. God blows into our nostrils a neshama of life. The breath in our nostrils represents the deepest part of the neshama. The reach, the smell, the purest part of the soul. It's that part of the soul which gives us the ruach, which is tiferet. Right? The ability to be completely selfless, the ability to let go of our disposition towards chesed or vura, comes from tiferet. Tiferet accesses, to be tiferet, you need to access that complete point of purity of the soul where we let go of ourselves and we don't worry about what we are responding, what we need or the way we are going to respond, but we worry about what is more beneficial for the purpose of creation, what is needed at the time, not what we want impulsively. Yeah, does that make sense? So therefore the reyach of the soul, the fragrance of the soul, which is in our nose, is connected to, it's the basis, it's also the root, the origin of the ruach. It's the origin of the tiferet, which comes out in our emotion, but it's that ability to harmonize, to see what is needed, to go beyond ourselves and to make decisions which are of value and purpose. Yeah? They didn't want to listen to Moshe Rabbeinu. They couldn't think of freedom. Why couldn't they think of freedom? Mikotzer ruach. Because shortness of ruach, shortness of breath. Why? What does that mean? So here we come to... Whoops. Can you just close that door? Thanks. So here we come to another Kabbalistic idea which is very much connected... Sorry? Aliyah and Avi, yeah. Right. So here we come to an amazing thing. Listen to this. We all have the ruach, right? We all have the soul. No one's missing a soul. Meaning, we all have the ability to live a life of meaning and purpose. We all have the ability to be selfless. We all have the ability to grow and be free. In fact, we all have the ability to have that part of the soul manifest itself in our thinking. We're all able to process information if we want to. That is good for us, right? And yet, not all of us, or not all the time at least, are able to live that way. In other words, we can get together and we can talk about the evils of rage, of losing our temper, correct? If anyone here has never lost their temper, the door's down the hallway, right? It's not for you, this thing. So why? Some of us lose our temper more than we should. We just went to a shiur where we talked about the evils of anger and how bad it is for us and how destructive it is for us and how ineffective it is long term. Right? We can all learn about the evils of resentment and yet we find it so difficult to let go. So it's not because of lack of a soul. It's not because of lack of the ability to grow. We all have that. What is the problem? The problem is as follows. The problem is we all have, you know, our physical body represents our spiritual personality. That's what Kabbalah teaches us, right? In fact, it's based on a verse which says, "Ubi psari echazeh eloka." From my flesh, I can see God because in the way my body is structured, I can work out how my soul works, and now my soul, I can work out godliness, right? And therefore, our physical structure of the body, we know, represents the 10 powers of the soul. So the three parts of our brain is the chokhmah min hadat. The heart is tiferet. The two arms of the chesed and the gevurah. The abdomen is the tiferet. The two legs and is netzachot yisod, and sexuality actually is yisod because it means connection, and Malchut is that communication and a way to implement it and so on. So, but there's a part of our soul, a part of our body, which is interesting, which doesn't seem to represent any of these ten. And that's the neck. The throat, right? And the throat is very narrow. And there's a disease, a Kabbalistic disease, a spiritual disease, which Kabbalah describes, called Meitzar Hagorem, the narrowness of the throat. Narrowness of the throat. Right? Why? What does that mean? Our greatest problem, normally, even if we are committed, I mean, now some people not even don't get past the depth of the soul, meaning certain people not even willing to engage in thinking about the right thing to do, or thinking about growth and freedom. Okay, but let's say we are, right? Let's say we are. And we are engaged in learning about things that are valuable, and things that are correct, and things that are moral, and things that are spiritual, and so on. But there's a big problem, because when you think about something, it needs, in order to live it, it needs to travel down and transition from the world of intellect to the world of emotion. And the problem is that intellect and emotion are completely different. So, by definition, right? The greatness of our mind is its weakness. What I mean? The greatness of our mind is that we can detach. We can look at something objectively. But that's its weakness also, because it's detached. It's not me. Well, so when I think of something, I can explain to you for a half an hour how bad it is to smoke, right? But that doesn't mean that I'm passionate about it, because it's in my mind. Intellectually, that's the way it is. Right? That's a good step to have the mind clear, but it's doesn't mean that I'm going to feel that way. Because feeling is an emotion. Emotion is subjective, which is its weakness. That's why we can't make choices. Once we get emotional, it's hard to make a choice, because we get trapped in who we are. Therefore, we need to take a step back and think. But thinking is detached. It's cold. Intellect and emotion are two different things. So therefore, the Zohar tells us that what needs to take place is that the intellect, what we think in our mind, and if we're thinking clearly, what we're thinking is the stuff that's based on our ruach, on our reach, on the depth of our soul, which lives in our mind, manifests itself in our mind. It has to travel down through the throat and land up in the heart. I'm giving the physical symbolism here, but that's what it is doing, right? But the same thing, happens in the spiritual. The problem is the throat is very, very narrow, and often it gets stuck and never makes it. And it needs tremendous effort to make sure that it does make it, right? In other words, we have five senses, remember? Five senses represent the four parts of the soul and the purity of the soul. The purity of the soul sometimes remains detached from the other four. The other four parts of our soul manifest itself in different parts of our makeup. The challenge for us is to connect the purity of the soul with the rest of the soul. So the rest of the soul, everything about us, that our emotions, our action, our behavior, is guided by the rest of the soul, by the purity of the soul. When the Jews were in Egypt, they were in a place called Mitzrayim. Right? What does the word Mitzrayim mean? Meitzar, narrowness. Kabbalah says that Mitzrayim represents the Meitzar Hagor, the narrowness of the throat. The inability to become free, because to be free is not enough just to think correctly. It's the ability to apply what's in your head to the rest of your body. Physically speaking, figuratively speaking also. Yeah? That's difficult. That's real freedom. Paro, who was the king of Egypt? Paro. Paro in Hebrew is Pei Resh Ayin Hei, which if you change around the letters, makes Ha'oref, the neck. Right? Because that's what Paro was. Paro was the ruler of Egypt. It's the narrowness of the neck holding back the transition from the head to the heart. From the Reach, from the Ruach, from the Tiferet, from the purity of the soul to be able to flow through the rest of the soul. So that when we think and feel and act and respond, we're always guided by the part, by the bottom part, by the deepest part of the soul. Okay. By the way, it also has to do with another part of the soul, communication, right? So para, remember, communication is also the representation of the ability of the soul to be infinite, to be free, communicating, connecting. But there's bad communication. The communication doesn't work. It doesn't allow you to connect. Again, paro. Another way you can break up the word paro is pera, a bad mouth. Bad communication, ineffective communication. It's not working. The communication is not being used properly to connect to someone else or to connect beyond yourself. Which is why Pesach, we have to fix that. We have to experience freedom. And Pesach stands for the two words that I said last week, Pesach, the mouth that talks, effective communication. Which is why the mitzvah on Seder night is Haggadah, to tell, to... Right? So, that's why we look at the Sefirot, for example. So that's why I showed you the triangles before, because we look at the Sefirot, we see the world of intellect, which is where really the soul also resides. That's the home of the soul. The depth of the soul is higher than intellect, but that's where it lives in that part of the person. But the problem is, it doesn't take it down. It doesn't come down. Often it doesn't come down. Shortness of breath. That's what it means, shortness of breath. They didn't listen to Moses because they were breathing shallow. They weren't breathing, only breathing in the mouth, in the nose. It didn't come down to the lungs. It didn't come down to the rest of the body. You want to ask something?
Is das the connection between the intellect and the emotion?
Yeah, so I don't want to go so much into this. So the way you do that, right? The way you do that is you use dat. Because you use always the middle tool is always the most powerful. And dat is you think about something for so long until you become it, until you start to feel it, to become passionate about it. In other words, it doesn't only become a concept anymore, it starts to become something who you are, and you is your emotions, really, right? Yeah, that's right, exactly right. So that's putting it all together now. Kotzer ruach, shortness of breath. Ruach is tiferet, right? Remember? Tiferet connects back to the purity of the soul. Tiferet originates in the reach of the soul. Reach, ruach, same word. It's in the deepest purity of the soul, which is the source of real freedom, the source of selflessness, the source of letting go of the ego. But when it's kotzer ruach, with a shortness of ruach, the ruach doesn't reveal in the heart. The tiferet is not blooming. It's stuck in the nostrils, stuck in the mouth. To be really free, you need the soul to breathe deeply. You need abdominal breathing. In the spiritual sense, the neshama sense. You need it to work harder so that it flows in, you feel it everywhere. Right? Now I wanted to bring it back to Purim. Yeah, sorry, you look confused. You okay?
No.
Oh, sorry, I thought you looked. You look like you had a question. Okay, no problem. So I want to bring it to Purim because Purim is this week, right? Purim is Thursday night, Friday. And Purim is an amazing yontif. Do you know what the Zohar says? Zohar says that Purim is higher than Yom Kippur. Right? It's a very powerful yontif. It's often missed. It's unfortunate. But it's a great yontif. You know why it says higher than Yom Kippur? Because Purim is called Purim. And Yom Kippur in the Machzor, where we daven, is called Yom Kippurim, right? Which means at a day like Purim. It's not quite Purim. Purim is deeper than Yom Kippur. Why? So I'll explain to you why. Both Purim and Yom Kippur, we are taught in Kabbalah, are days where we reach a very deep level of the soul. The Jews in Purim's story were able to reach a very... They'd messed up on all four levels, and that's why the decree came from Haman, which is a whole other discussion. And they repented by really digging deep and reawakening the we call in Yiddish, the pintalayir, the real essence of who they were, the essence of the soul. Yom Kippur is the same way, and that's why Purim, as I said last week, is so connected with fragrance. Esther, her name was Hadassah, which is Hadassah, myrtle, which is fragrance. Mordechai comes from the word Maradachia, which is one of the spices used in the temple. Again, fragrance, right? Because both days connect very deeply to the essence of the soul. Yom Kippur, we find this also, because Yom Kippur, there's, you know, every day we have a different number of prayers. So on a normal day, there's three prayers. We call Shacharit, the morning prayer, the afternoon prayer, the evening prayer. On Shabbat and Chagim, there's an extra one called Musaf. Yom Kippur is the only day of the year we have five prayers. We have Ne'ilah as well at the end. Ne'ilah is the fifth prayer, which corresponds to the fifth part of the soul, the deepest part of the soul, right? And so Yom Kippur, we do that and we connect to a very high level. But at the end of the day, Yom Kippur is a day that we reach this amazing spirituality, an amazing depth of the soul, but in a very non-physical context, right? It's very pure, but it's very detached from the rest of the world. So we're fasting, we're in shul, we're hearing a drasha, we're trying to be inspired, we open up the ark. It's a very, very spiritual moment. And as holy as that is, as we say in Yiddish, that's not the tachlis. It's not the ultimate. You have to go through that because that's how you reveal the soul, because the soul is so spiritual. So you need a Yom Kippur to leave everything, to shed everything about us and just connect with the purest of who we are, right? But even higher than Yom Kippur is Purim. Why? Because Purim, look at the mitzvot of Purim, they're the total opposite to Yom Kippur. Purim, we eat hamantashen. Right? Purim, we say l'chaim. We give gifts of food to each other. We give gifts to the poor. Those are the mitzvot of Purim, right? Purim is not even a day like other chagim where work is prohibited. It's not. Purim, you can light a fire, you can go in a car, you can even do business. It's not a day which is holy in that sense, not detached from reality. Why? Because Purim is the ultimate of spiritual deep breathing. What I mean by that is, with Purim we saw that we connected to the deepest part of our neshama, but we're going to take that fifth level and make it influence everything that we do. Because one can be in a state of complete purity, one can be in a state where you connect to the purest part of our soul, but then when you come back to reality, not necessarily it transfers, right? Not necessarily that it's going to affect the other parts of the soul. The other parts of the soul which relate to our subconscious, to our the way we think, the way we feel, the way we behave, all those other parts of the soul, not necessarily we're going to be living in accordance and under the influence and under the inspiration of that fifth level of the soul, the reyach, the tiferet, the real depth of the soul. Because we go back into a new reality. Yom Kippur, we're in one sort of reality, but then we go to different. Purim is this concept. Purim is this very idea, where we take that fragrance of the soul, the purity of the soul, but we fill the rest of our body with it. That even when that it doesn't become a detached thing, it doesn't become something that lives in the brain or even higher than the brain, but never comes through the throat. Never, right? It's the gift of true freedom, which we then expand on, elaborate on during Pesach. But it's that idea of the whole day, right? Living by the inspiration of that fragrance of the soul. I'll just give you an example, sort of from a more modern context, which maybe sort of makes it clearer. So you look in the literature of mindfulness, right? They talk about mindful living, right? So so they give us mindful exercises so that we learn to focus. So right, mindful exercises have a lot to do with mindful meditation, and so on and so forth. But if you look at good mindfulness literature, they make a very, very obvious point, right? And the obvious point is that mindfulness is not about the 20 minutes a day that you meditate. Because if you meditate for 20, whatever it is, or whatever meditation you go through, but then the rest of the day you run around like a chicken without its head and you're just all over the place, that's not mindful living, right? The purpose of the mindful exercise is just to connect to the ability to be mindful, which you then, and this is the real challenge, or opportunity, I should say, is to take it the rest of the day and apply it, that when you are rushing around, you're rushing mindfully. Or you're answering a phone, or you're talking to someone else, or you're eating, or you're praying, or whatever you're doing it mindfully, right? So when we're doing lots of things, when we're going about our normal routine of the day, that's not conscious mindfulness, but when we're living mindfully, we're living under the inspiration of that mindfulness exercise that we did, right? I mean, it's a similar thing in the physical sense when you go to the gym, for example, right? Or you go for exercise. I mean, exercise is a healthy way of living, but the healthy way of living is not the exercise. Exercise just gets our muscles moving or gets the blood circulating, whatever it does, right? The idea is to then live the entire day healthy. And the same thing is in the spiritual. You can, there's that relationship, as I said before, in the second introduction, between the four and the five. Right? So the fifth level of the soul, that's the reyach, that's the purest part of the soul. But it's got to make its way through, not just the nose and the mouth. It can't be kotzer ruach. It can't be shortness of breath. It's got to be full. It's got to fill our lungs. It's got to fill everything that we do. So there are times that we have a Yom Kippur, and that it's a symbolism of lots of times. There are times where we have to just think about it and be conscious of it and detach from the rest of everything and just connect to purity. But that's just a means to an end. That's just connecting to that fifth level. The real purpose is to take that fifth level and let it throw through the five. The rest of the five, the four. Right? To make it through the narrowness of the throat, to learn how to communicate properly, to learn how to grow in everything that we do. To learn how to apply meaning and purpose and selflessness and spirituality and divinity, that spark that's at the very, very essence of who we are, that reyach of the neshama, how to apply it to everything that we do. That's the challenge. And that's the symbolism of Purim, because Purim is a day we do our regular routine, and yet such a powerful day. Purim stands for this concept of eating hamantashen with meaning and purpose, right? Celebrating with meaning and purpose, going about our regular routine day, which is all the rest of the soul, but under the influence of that soul. So that's the real depth of the Kabbalah breathing, which is the, as I said, this discussion was more on how to take that. The breath is in our nostrils. Vayipach ba'apav nishmat chayim. God blew into the nostrils. That's where it lives. That's where it starts. Connected to our thinking. That's where it begins. Where we begin to process the concept of true meaning and purpose, but and freedom. But really, where it is, it's when you fill the rest of ourselves with it, and that's how we do away with the kotzer ruach. It's not shortness of breath, but it's breathing properly, which represents the concept of filling our soul, filling our entire, the rest of our soul, the lungs of our soul, so to speak, with the purity of the soul. Make sense? Is that clear? Yeah. So let's practice it a bit. Let's try and internalize it a little bit. Just spend a few minutes together with a bit of a meditation. Just get comfortable. And when you're ready and relaxed, just try and focus a bit and slowly close your eyes. And just in a very simple way, as we normally do, just begin by turning your attention to your breathing. Breathing in and out, just slowly connecting to the rhythm and just paying attention, first of all. As we breathe, just reflect on the relationship between Neshima and Neshama. Initially, let's connect to the Neshama in our nostrils, the depth of our soul, the purity, the blowing of God, a piece of the divine, a piece of Himself given to the human being. As we breathe, just stay focused if we can, and just think about the purity of our neshama expressed in our neshima. The spark, the depth of meaning, the part of us that is selfless, desires purpose, craves spirituality, craves connection, craves growth. And as we focus on our neshama, let's try and take a few deeper breaths. We're going to try and breathe deeply in, hold it there for a moment, and slowly out. Just experience the feeling of breathing in deeply, breathing out slowly. Just try it for a few moments. Breathe in, 2, 3, 4, slowly breathe out. In, 2, 3, slowly breathe out. Just keep doing this for a few moments and try to feel the breath in your abdomen. Try to feel the sensation of your abdomen expanding and contracting. Try to feel your lungs filling up and then feel the sensation of letting go. As you keep focusing on your feeling of your breath all over beyond your head and nostrils, connect to the other layers of the neshama, of the soul, our intellect, our subconscious, our emotion, our behavior. And as you breathe in deeply, filling the rest of the parts of your body with your air, as the reyach, the fragrance of your neshama, travels to the other parts of your neshama, think of that purity of the soul infusing the rest of your soul. Think of that which is in your head making it through the narrowness of the throat. To feel it, to live it, to have that sensation in our other parts of our existence, other parts of our personality. Try to imagine the purity of our soul taking over everything, feeling it everywhere. Feel a sense of purpose each day. To apply and live by a sense of purpose each day. The purity of the neshama, the selflessness, the meaning to fill and extend beyond just the nostrils. To create synthesis, harmony throughout every part of who we are. Just hold on to that as just try for a few more moments. Think about that as you breathe deeply and breathe out slowly. If your mind wanders, as it often does throughout the day, to other things, losing the connection to the reyach of the soul, just non-judgmentally and slowly, calmly, just bring it back. Bring it back to each inhalation and each exhalation. Feeling it in every part of your body, feeling your abdomen expand and contract, feeling your lungs filled, feeling the calmness throughout. Try to extend that now to consciousness of the other parts of who you are. Feel your hands. Pay attention to where you're sitting and the feeling of sitting. Pay attention to your feet and where they're touching, the floor, the chair. Extend the consciousness to every part of who we are. So that all the senses, all the number four, can be inspired by the number five. Let's hold that and take it with us, and remember, every time we breathe, Remember the depth, the power, the infinity of our soul. But remember to deep beyond the throat into the rest of who we are. When you're ready, slowly come back to where we are and open your eyes, and let's try and hold on to this, and let's try and take an inspiration, connect it to Purim, as we said, and try and build a consciousness. And the way we do that, I think, throughout the day is when we, like I said last week, when we feel ourselves unraveling, it's time to stop, reconnect, pay attention to our breathing, pay attention to our neshama, and then try and extend it again to everything that we are. It's a life work, it's a constant progress, but that's the journey of the growth and the freedom of the human being, the spiritual freedom of the human being. So that's in a nutshell. There's so much more to talk about, obviously, but I'll leave it for there for now. I hope that was clear. And we will have other Kabbalah series in the future. Mandy inspired me, so now we're going to do some more Kabbalah things. Please stay tuned to the WhatsApps, to the emails, and so on. And also, may I suggest that this Friday is Purim, so try and connect to Purim somehow. It's a pity to miss it. There are different things happening, so even simple, the mitzvot are very simple. Just send a food basket to someone, to a neighbor. Just give a couple of coins to charity. It's a very easy mitzvot. Have a festive meal. What can be better than that? And connect to the happiness of and the connection. So Purim Sameach to everyone, and only good things. You're welcome.